Hello and welcome to Frame to Frame, the podcast that takes two completely unrelated films and slams them together with a thematic link, whether it's tenuous or not. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
This week we're going to be talking about showmanship of the 19th century. So as we revealed on our Twitter feed on Friday, which is what we do every week, we will be talking about two films which show different aspects of showmanship within the 1800s. Oddly enough, they both star Hugh Jackman. So today we're going to be talking about The Greatest Showman and The Prestige. Now, Sean, tell me a bit about the relationship you've got with these two films.
Well, I love one of them and hate the other one. So this is going to be interesting.
It is. We haven't done a film that we specifically dislike, or one of us specifically dislikes. We've done sort of films we felt a bit ambivalent about. So in the past, we've done our comfort food movies, films about the media in 1976, World War II through the eyes of children. So sort of these really tenuous links. But oddly enough, we haven't had films that one of us particularly hates as yet.
Yeah, we've been oddly simpatico, but I think that's about to come crashing down quite spectacularly. Although I will say the common denominator, Hugh Jackman, I really like Hugh Jackman both as a person and as an actor.
As a person?
No, but I've seen him interviewed. I've never interviewed him, but I would really like to, because he comes across as a genuinely nice person, and he is a brilliant actor, and appropriately enough, a very fine showman, because he came out of musicals before. Obviously, he starred in the first X-Men movie as Wolverine, so that's kind of appropriate for what we're talking about.
Well, yes, and that was something we were going to hit on.
I've preempted it.
It's fine. I'm used to you by now. So the first film we're going to talk about is The Greatest Showman, and it might shock some people to learn that this was the one that Sean was talking about, in that he didn't particularly like it. So just to give you a sort of brief background, if anybody hasn't seen the films, please go and watch them. We probably will be discussing all sorts of twists and turns. Not that there are great twists and turns in The Greatest Showman, but there are in The Prestige. So we probably will be discussing those. So The Greatest Showman, that is about P.T. Barnum, who it's always been his dream to set up some sort of circus, in which he does. The museum that he initially sets up fails, so he ends up getting a load of people that are misfits and bandies them together and becomes a success in his own field. So tell me about how you feel about the film, Sean.
Well, the first thing to say there is, you said it's about P.T. Barnum. It's not really about P.T. Barnum, is it? It's a fantastical, fictionalized take on the life of P.T. Barnum, who in real life was not a very nice man and was exploitative and treated animals and his, well, they were essentially slaves, weren't they, really, the people that he had working for him. But believe me, that's not my problem with the movie, because let's face it, most films with a historical basis warp the truth to varying degrees in either subtle or overt ways. Mm-hmm. This film is thunderingly unsubtle in the way that it smashes history underfoot, but I don't necessarily have an issue with that, because this isn't the only movie that's done that. So I think
it's also done it for the sake of its own story. What it's trying to tell you is a fantastical story set in the 1800s about a go-getter who's, it's almost the American dream story, isn't it? You try hard enough for something, you can accomplish anything.
But the critical thing is that with any American dream story, it can champion success. It also has to go really dark and explore the ugly underbelly of it. And I don't think this movie does it particularly well. It starts to do it and then it backs off and it goes into a kind of
superficial. It's got very little interest in doing that.
That's a problem.
It's a rip-roaring good time. It's not a problem at all. It's a rip-roaring good time kind of film. So it starts you off with the earworm of The Greatest Show, which is the great way to set off any musical, is to have the title of the song at the end of, or the title of the musical at the end of the first song. You can think of Wicked. You can think of The Book of Mormon. You can think of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. The whole point is that at the end of that first song, you've set the tone for where you're going to be going. And they do that very, very well in this film. So we're going to be seeing something flamboyant, something a bit different, something a bit out there. And then we cut back to seeing the characters that grow up to be Hugh Jackman and Michelle Williams, who I'm sure we'll come to in a minute. So we see them as children, and then they end up singing another fantastic song to each other about A Million Dreams. So, and that's something that's reprised a little bit later when we're looking at them as adults. So we're probably, 5-10 minutes into the film, we've already had two outlandishly good-looking scenes shot, like, fantastically well. That shot of the two of them on... You're looking at me like I'm being slightly strange.
Yeah, but... see, my face would be a picture of anyone if this was being live streamed. When you said the words fantastically shot there, I actually grimaced.
Yeah, which is
finish your point. I'm not talking yet. You finish your point.
So my point being, they're fantastically shot because you look at that scene when they're on the rooftop and it's just old school Hollywood. You've got this gigantic, this humongous moon overlooking them, setting the light, and then there's a dance sequence around it, and it is just old school Hollywood. And I find it a little bit strange that you can look at this film and say that it's not good, and you can say what you will say about it and still enjoy things like La La Land, which go off into flights of fancy. You can still enjoy The Shape of Water, which also has its strange little dance sequence in it. And that's what it is. That's what this whole film is about. It's about the fantasy of the musical told through the American dream story.
The key differences with La La Land and The Shape of Water is that they were technically very, very well made and had brilliant characters and brilliant scripts. And also in the case of La La Land, it had really, really good songs. And I think the problem that I have with The Greatest Showman is that it's built on quicksand. And I think musicals are a very, very subjective experience, which is, if you don't like the music of said musical, everything else gets sucked into a black hole. And I think that's my fundamental problem with this, is that I find the songs utterly bland, and I think it's a weird, very weird decision to take a story set in the 19th century, ostensibly based on a real person, though not really, not the way the film portrays it, and to basically make everything sound like a kind of X Factor, Britain's Got Talent approach. I know that will get the audience on board, but I'm kind of like, you know, this is a movie about P.T. Barnum. It's a movie about the circus. The music should be aping the conventions of the time, like vaudeville, orchestra, brass band. You know, why is there this droning auto-tune? The amount of auto-tune I can't sing, but when I watched The Greatest Show, I was like, oh my goodness, what have they done to their voices? It's that, you know, that I find really, really problematic. But I will say, to stop being grinchy for a minute, that the only redeeming feature of the film, and I think to make the point to reiterate the theme of this particular episode, we're talking about showmanship, so let's not make it just about me ragging on The Greatest Showman, or I could do that for hours.
And you will still be wrong. Hours later, you will be absolutely wrong.
But I'm not wrong about this point. Hugh Jackman is the best thing in the film. Far and away the best thing in the film. And
he carries the film. Like way that Barnum carries the musical numbers that he's singing in front of the audience, that's what Hugh Jackman does to this film. And you can tell that it's a pet project of his. Like you said, he's got the theatre experience. He's got that aura and that presence. He's got even movie musical experience with Les Mis at this point. So you can tell that it's a passion project for him, and he absolutely carries this film.
He does, and I think right from that opening shot when he's silhouetted and it's profile, and I think, okay, Hugh Jackman is very, very charismatic, which only makes it all the more frustrating that I don't think he's given the songs or the choreography to work with. And I had to take umbrage when you said, sorry about this, I had to take umbrage when you said it's fantastically shot. I think it's a really badly, it was not so much badly shot as badly edited. It's like that you don't, for me, it's edited so haphazardly that you don't actually get any sense of the choreography. And I think this goes back to La La Land. La La Land is a brilliantly shot movie because you get a sense of the physical movement of the characters, which is really fundamental, like long takes. You get a sense of the space that they occupy. This is like cut, 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 cut. You know, people prancing around, waving batons in the air, and, you know, CGI animals, really badly animated CGI animals will come into frame on the left and right. And I'm like, what kind of universe is this movie occupying? Who's it for? I find that for me, it had all the conviction of a Christmas pantomime on Brighton Pier.
Right, I'm going to cut you off here. I've let you talk now. I'm not having that. You're not comparing it to pantomime. So, and to come back to the other point you made about not having the long takes, is that a musical number where Hugh Jackman and Zac Efron are in a bar, and it's a song called The Other Side, and that is literally a long take, then a cut, then a long take, then a cut. So,
I'll concede that one.
I mean, and even when you go to the end, the reprise of The Greatest Show, you have the whole cast moving in unison like you would on a stage show. And there are certain moments in the film that absolutely remind me of sitting in a theatre and watching a show, which I think is what they were striving for.
That, I think you've just got to the heart of it there. I think there are two very different types of movie musical. There are cinematic movie musicals, which La La Land, and then there are movie musicals that look like theatre productions that have been put onto the big screen. I think it's probably no surprise to learn that I favour the former. The former approach, which is kind of, you know, resplendent, lovely, like widescreen vistas, long takes, you know, proper characters. And I think this kind of very much falls into the latter category.
You look at the history of the movie musical, and so many have come from stage shows.
Yeah, but there's a difference between it coming from a stage show and it looking like a stage show on the big screen. I mean,
the old sort of Fred and Ginger films, and
but
they are very much on a stage, and they're on a sound stage, and when it's aped in Hail Caesar, like, that's exactly what it looked like at the time, and that's exactly what the films looked like at the time.
Fred and Ginger, it felt cinematic. It didn't feel like you were dealing with, you know, sort of tawdry sets and, you know, slapdash editing that kind of makes a nonsense out of where people are like dancing. You know, you need when in musicals, you need to get a sense of the physical space of the environment in which people are dancing. And I think the problem with a film like The Greatest Showman is that it's almost like it's got ADHD. It's kind of jumping around all over the place, and I don't really get a sense of, you know, the effort that the choreographers and the actors have kind of gone into. When you look at Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the way that even though it might have a stagey air to it, the way that they shot it completely indulges the two actors, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. They are the stars of their sequences. It's not the editing, it's not the special effects and the gaudy, like throwing glitter and, you know, everything at the screen. I mean, maybe this is just me being unbelievably grouchy, and I know I'm on the back foot with this because The Greatest Showman was astonishingly successful. So
it had 11 the soundtrack album had 11 consecutive weeks at number one. So
yeah, which is,
you talk about the songs not being great, just saying.
I know. I mean, what do I know? But it's kind of it's I think, again, it goes back to my earlier point, which is musicals are probably more subjective than any other genre, barring perhaps comedy, because, you know, that there is that weird thing when a comedy doesn't work, it's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. And humor is really personal, because some of the most heated arguments I've had have been regarding comedies, in terms of like somebody finds something funny and somebody else doesn't, and then all of a sudden there's an argument because the person that did find the movie funny takes offense at, like, well, how could you not find that funny? Can you not take the same pleasure in it?
That goes back to our discussion of mock rock docs, doesn't it? The whole, you know, Spinal Tap stuff. But I just think that the Greatest Showman, when you look at, like, Rewrite the Stars, the song where you have Zac Efron and Zendaya on ropes, and how can you not be impressed with the choreography of that?
Because to all intents and purposes, she's Spider-Woman in that scene. I mean, just the way that she's like flailing around all over the place. I mean, I know there was a stunt person on the set, but again, it's not so much what they did on the set. It's the way they've interpreted it in post-production, the way they've edited it, the way they've graded the film. It just looks silly. I think that's just, and not in a fantastical escapist way. It just looks silly, as in the sense they were trying to work out how the hell to interpret the physical, the raw footage, the dailies that they got on the set. And it's just, yeah, I said you said this was going to be combative.
I did, and I completely think it is, because, you know, it's got, I'm not going to sit here and put it at the same level as, you know, some of the great movie musical classics.
Well, such as?
Such as, like, The Sound of Music and Mary Poppins. And
Singing in the Rain.
Singing in the Rain, obviously. Yeah. So I'm not going to try and put it in that same category. It is cheesy, it's corny, and it's got a weird sentiment to it. But I loved it. I thought it was great, and especially, like you say, that on the theme of the showmanship, that, like you said, the showmanship within the film is fantastic, especially the sort of the passing of baton at the end between Hugh Jackman and Zac Efron's characters. Then when Zac Efron is the one to go out and be the ringleader, how he then changes the song, A, to fit his own voice, but also incorporates himself within the wider choreography. It worked for me. And it's worked several times. I will admit, it didn't work well first time. But on sort of several watchings afterwards and listening to the soundtrack, I found the whole thing entertaining, which I think is what they were striving for. I don't think they were looking to make a cinematic piece about the history of cinema, which is pretty much what La La Land is.
No, I wasn't expecting them to do that. I was expecting to make a decent musical that looks good and has got good music in it, which is the basic thing I expect from a, you know, movie musical. Can we also address, you mentioned this earlier, the other one of the other really offensive things in the movie,
Michelle Williams,
which is that Michelle Williams's character is basically destined to just fall head over heels for Hugh Jackman and then watch passively on the sidelines while he seduces Rebecca Ferguson, who lip syncs her way through opera in one of the most stupid sequences that I've seen in a film in recent memory. I'm like, you know, if you're gonna get somebody who can't sing, you know, you can't get somebody who's not an opera singer and then get them to mime to opera. That's
I didn't find the miming that bad. I had this exact same discussion whilst watching the film with my wife, and I didn't find the lip syncing that bad. I think, yeah, you know, fine, she fits the look of the film. She's a classically beautiful woman, which is what they need in that scene. So, yeah, sure, yeah. Fine, it worked for me.
But then why didn't they just get a classically good opera singer who could also act and get them in the film instead?
I can't answer
make,
that.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Can't answer it. I wasn't on set.
Yeah, well, exactly. No, none of us were. And again, it's one of those baffling aesthetic decisions that I think, for me, completely derails the film. And again, they're trying to make a point about showmanship. And they cast the wrong person. I like Rebecca Ferguson. She's done some really fine performances, noticeably in Doctor Sleep, but she clearly wasn't the right person for that. And yeah, and Michelle Williams, who is such a mercurial, brilliant performer in pretty much everything, yeah. Michelle Williams is pretty flawless. To saddle her with the wife left at home. Yeah, in the mansion, just like weeping every now and then. She'll put a handkerchief to like either side of her face and dab in that kind of movie way. I'm like, Michelle Williams deserves so much more than that.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you.
You actually agree with me there?
Yeah, she's underused and she's kind of marginalized as the wife character. I completely agree with you.
And she's just a prop. And again, I think this kind of goes into my problem with the film, which is the film is very superficial. The film ultimately is only interested in success. It's not interested in probing the dark side of success. It's not the film glosses over that in the form of the Michelle Williams character. It's like, oh, we're not concerned about that. But you know, this guy is an entrepreneur. He's created a circus of misfits. Yeah, sure, he indulges in a little bit of infidelity, but it's all right in the end. We'll forgive him that.
He flatly doesn't. He gets manipulated by Rebecca Ferguson's character. Infidelity, but it's not what he was doing. He was trying to increase his own profile by going across the country with her and trying to sort of shut out the quote-unquote band of freaks that he was with and look, now I'm accepted by high society, so I don't need you anymore.
Yeah. All right, I'll take your point on that. So yeah, fair enough. You clarified the storytelling detail there, but my point is that needed to be expanded on. That particular plot point shouldn't be a catalyst to the standard Hollywood redemption of, right, I started good, I went a bit off the rails, and now I've kind of emerged as this kind of redemptive big top leader. It's kind of like, I think there was a more interesting, well, clearly there was a more interesting story to be told in there in the form of P.T. Barnum's life, which they didn't do.
No, they didn't want to do that.
They didn't want to do that, no.
Interestingly enough, though, there is actually a stage show about P.T. Barnum's life called Barnum. And I saw it recently. I say recently, it was a while ago now. Starring Brian Connolly as P.T. Barnum himself. And that was a little less fantastical and a little more, I'd argue, realistic than The Greatest Showman. But it is significantly less memorable. So,
interesting. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I raised with you on WhatsApp before we started talking about this, again, not to try and turn it into a diatribe, although I suppose it's a bit too late for that.
It is absolutely too late for that.
The use of the critic character, which is just one of the most eye-rollingly like fatuous things that a movie like this can do. And so, the idea of the critic is set up as like the sort of beard-stroking bad guy who sits in the audience. And you know, the ironic thing being that the way the critic critiques Barnum's act in the movie would actually be a suitable critique of how Barnum behaved in real life. So if anything, the critic is not the baddie. The critic is the person who actually saw the situation for what it was. But everything about the scenes in which he turns up, it's like, oh, boo hiss. He doesn't understand what mass entertainment is. It's like, well, you know, you kind of need people to cut through the noise and just tell it as it is.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. However, I will retort to that, which is...
You're Samuel L. Jackson.
I will. And that's exactly the reception this film received. This film received a really, really poor reception from critics, and it was the audience that made it the hit that it was. And some critics have even sort of revised their opinion upon subsequent watching. And I just think that, okay, fair enough, it's a relatively easy target to have a critic as a baddie and then, you know, make them a little bit uppity, a bit hoity-toity. And I get that. But it's also proven correct in that that's exactly what happened to this film.
But they wouldn't have known. They obviously put that critic... They shot the movie. They wouldn't have known what kind of critical reception was going to greet the movie before the movie came out. So it's kind of like they built in that fail-safe. They kind of knew what kind of film they were making, and they put that character in there because they knew exactly what was gonna happen. And it's kind of like, oh, it's just...
No, they needed him there. They needed somebody to give Barnum the drive to be accepted, yeah. And that started with having poor reviews. So he then needed to be accepted, which is then why he took on the Rebecca Ferguson character and started touring around with her. So you needed somebody like that in order to instigate that part of the narrative. So I didn't see it that as that much of a huge problem.
I mean, you actually explained that really well, actually. Yeah, I mean, I suppose in the context of the film's narrative, it does make sense. I just wish that they'd treated it with a bit more discretion. I mean, just literally everything about the way the critic acts, like the minute that he first turns up, he's kind of shot from like a high angle, so that what we're kind of looking down on him. Everything about his body language is meant to suggest, oh, he's like hispy, he doesn't get anything. And it's kind of like, for goodness sake, it's just like it's quite crass. And I just, you know, and it's obviously so manipulative. It's obviously designed to get audiences around the world, and presumably most audiences did this. It's like, oh, you know, I hate you. You know, you can't. It's really, really problematic for me.
I get the problem, but I don't agree with it in this scenario. But the one thing that we can agree on is that Hugh Jackman pulls off an absolute magic trick with his performance as P.T. Barnum. And speaking of Hugh Jackman being magical, he was also in 2005 in the Christopher Nolan film in The Prestige.
Now we're talking.
Yes, now we are talking. He stars alongside Christian Bale and Scarlett Johansson and Michael Caine and David Bowie, and we could go on, in a period piece about magicians of the time. Sean, tell us a bit about this film.
So this was adapted from Christopher Priest's novel, which is actually a very interesting novel. I'd recommend people go and read it. Set in the late 19th century about two warring magicians, Borden, played by Christian Bale, as you said, and Angier, played by Hugh Jackman. Borden, lower class, Angier, upper class, but he's kind of had to keep, because he's worried that his wealthy family will frown on him and sneer on him for indulging in magical pursuits. So two magicians, Borden, very, very good at the technical expertise of magic, but a terrible showman. Angier, the opposite, great showman, but not a great technician. And he is reliant on Michael Caine's character, Cutter, the props man, who starts off, he's like, every magic trick is three parts. Or
oh, X. It's taken us literally minutes to get to Michael Caine impression.
He's like, the first act is called, and so he goes, you got the turn, the pledge, and the prestige. And it's about the movie mirrors the three act magic structure between the pledge, the turn, and the prestige. Between the pledge, the introduction of the apparently ordinary object, the turn, where the ordinary object is twisted into something extraordinary, and the prestige, which is the apparently impossible final reveal that apparently was there in front of the audience all along, but which the audience doesn't dare to admit because apparently it was too simple. The explanation is apparently too simple for that. And the movie traces their rivalry and their quest to outdo the other in pursuit of the perfect magic trick, which primarily manifests in the form of this trick called the transported man, which adopts various guises throughout the years. And I, hand on heart, I think this is Christopher Nolan's best film. I think it's fantastic. I know you don't. Now it's your turn to disagree with me.
Yeah, but I mean, we're debating semantics at this point. I think The Dark Knight works better for me as a film.
And The Dark Knight is fantastic. Yeah,
we're splitting hairs at this point. I really like the Prestige when it came out. I did think it was Chris Nolan's best film.
And then Dark Knight turned up.
The Dark Knight came out. So, I'm not really going to argue with you on this, but. I just think that the whole idea of the transporting man and the magic act between the two, as well as the layering of the different themes throughout the film. So you've got this this idea of sort of obsession and secrecy, but also you have all this different class warfare going on and sort of the romanticism between it all and the idea of... having science as magic as well really sort of hit home. And the fact that they've got all these things going on whilst it's simultaneously a really entertaining thriller at the end of the day. To have all of that going on and juggling it all, I can completely understand why you'd say it's Nolan's best film.
I mean, it's a very, very clever film because not only does it adopt the structure of a three-act magic trick, it also... it also assimilates the thrill that you get when you watch a really good magic trick. There's nothing quite like watching magic being performed in front of you and getting to the end of the trick and thinking, how the hell did they do that? Mm. And Nolan's movie, it's a simulation of that as well, because it's really, really clever, because right from the opening shot, when the camera pans across the ground, you see a lot of discarded top hats, and then Christian Bale's little bit of narration comes in. Are you watching closely? And then we're in. And you're grabbed, you're hooked, you think. Mm-hmm. But when you first watch the film, you don't realise that actually that shot tells you
exactly
what's going to happen.
That's the prestige.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. And then you, from that bit, that you cut to a shot of birds in cages, out of which Michael Caine takes one of which out of the cage. And that shot of things in cages mm-hmm. is also... an illusion of foreshadowing of what happens at the end. So it's all there. The question, the controversial aspect of the film, it relates to the nature of the final reveal, which I can kind of get because it does dip into science fiction, obviously with spoilers now. Yeah. What it turns out that what happens is that in pursuit of... the ultimate magic trick, Angier goes to America and meets with Nikola Tesla, the famous scientist played in this case by David Bowie.
Played amazingly by David Bowie as well.
Really, really, really good, really enigmatic, really weird. And Tesla
as you'd expect
built him
from Bowie.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lovely interview with Christopher Nolan, actually, that I was reading just before we did this about working with Bowie on Entertainment Weekly, which people ought to check out because it's really lovely and really moving. But Tesla builds him a machine which will apparently help Angier perfect the ultimate magic act. And at the end of the film, you realise that what's happened is it's actually tripped over into magic being real. All the way through, we're told that there is a practical, logical grounding for any magic trick. And the movie actually turns out to take a turn for the science fiction, because what Angier is doing in his transported man, or the real transported man, I forgot the name of it at the end, it goes through several variations, is that what he's doing is that he is duplicating himself. And one version of him falls beneath the stage into a tank and drowns. The other person emerges on the other side of the audience as the Prestige and it savors the applause, because he is an applause monkey. That, unlike Borden, he is there for the applause. He wants to be there in the audience to see, as he says at the very end, when he's been shot by Borden and he's dying, it was about the looks on their faces, which is incredibly one of several very spine-chilling lines in the movie. I can understand why the nature of that reveal would be troubling for people, because it would appear to be a betrayal of the film's principles, in the idea that you've gone through so much of the movie saying that all magic has got a pragmatic explanation. It's like, whoa, hang on a minute. All of a sudden, Nikola Tesla built a duplicating machine and it works.
But the way that Borden does the trick, which is to have a twin brother known as Fallon, who acts as him in real life, and they both share the one personality. And when one loses a finger, the other also has to lose a finger. And the way that that's sort of woven through the film, in that, you know, different people comment on, oh, some days he's just like this and some days he's not. And there's all that different threading of the needle, which Nolan being Nolan is an absolute master of doing that. You know, he's done that throughout his cinematography so far. You know, you look at Dunkirk, when you've got the hours, the days, and the weeks, or minutes, days, and hours. And you look at Inception when you've got the different layers of dreams. You look at Insomnia when you've got just the witheringness of Al Pacino. When you've got Memento, he's telling a whole story backwards and forward. But I think you're right in that the Prestige is possibly where he is at his most intelligent, without necessarily knowing he's at that most intelligent. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not.
Yeah, I do. I think you brought the point up there where the reveal of what Tesla's machine is doing, and I know there are a lot of theories online that the machine doesn't actually duplicate Angier come the end, and people have like argued tooth and nail about whether the machine works and whether there's another explanation for it. I happen to believe that I think the film makes it quite clear that the machine does work. I think that's the whole idea of it. I mean, I suppose what the point you were saying there was the idea of doubling, and the idea when you have a double, you have to make a sacrifice. Like you said, Borden had to sacrifice his fingers. Each Borden shares half of the other person's life. They share wives. Like Rebecca Hall's character is probably the only sympathetic character in the film, and she pays the price for this shared life between the two Borden characters without knowing it. And I suppose it makes emotional sense, even though the machine's outcome might be outlandish. It makes emotional sense because it plays into the idea of sacrifice, the idea that every night one Angier has to die and the other Angier savors the applause. But Angier doesn't know which version of him is going to suffer the agony of drowning. And then there is that horrifying cost when you realize the very last shot of the film shows the at least one duplicated Angier in the tank, and you kind of realize the nature of the sacrifice that he's made in pursuit of the Prestige, which mirrors with what Borden has been doing, which he's been sharing half a life with his twin brother Fallon. It's such a brilliant film. It's so well put together.
It is, and you know, when we're looking at it through the prism of showmanship, I think what it does particularly well is it shows some of the pitfalls in chasing celebrity, which is something that you mentioned The Greatest Showman doesn't do, and I think The Greatest Showman isn't interested in doing. But that's what The Prestige does, I think, extremely well in showing like we said, the nature of the obsession between the two of them on getting that perfect trick. And I think Michael Caine is just a fantastic character as well. I think he's, as the supportive engineer, I think he's...
he's great. He's really good. I mean, there's that incredibly chilling moment where at the beginning, which is what turns Angier and Borden against each other, look, Angier loses his wife in a drowning accident, and it's all to do with the knot that one of the Bordens tied, although obviously we and Hugh Jackman's character don't know that there are two of them at that point. So therefore, one Borden can't explain the knot that the other Borden tied. And Michael Caine, he talks about a sailor who almost drowned, and then he came back to life, and he said it was like going home. And then that line comes back up at the end. He's like, I once told you about a sailor who relayed his experience of drowning. And then Angier, who is obviously revealed to be Lord Caldlow, the English aristocrat at this point, that's his other identity, goes, yes, he told me it was like going home. I lied. He said it was agony. And you think, oh, God. And that line is chilling because the current
because of what
Angier.
Yes.
Yeah, he realizes what he's been doing. Yeah, yeah, he grasps it, and then he says, "And no one cares about the man in the box." And that's what's been going on. It is a brilliant film about showmanship. I mean, the dark side of showmanship. I think that technically it's brilliant. I mean, Wally Pfister's cinematography is just it's great. It doesn't have a lot of the cliches that you would expect a movie like this to have. It's got quite a, I don't quite know how to describe it. It's almost got quite like a modern look to it, even though it's got a period setting. It doesn't overdo it with the, you know, the grime and the muck on the streets. You know, normally in movies like this, you would expect cliches, wouldn't you? You'd expect like fog and things like that. It doesn't quite, it's a gloomy film. It's a dark film, visually dark film, but it doesn't go in for all that. I think it was shot in Los Angeles, and it does have, interestingly, given what we were talking about with The Great Showman, it does have quite a stagey, The Prestige does have quite a stagey set-like air to it, which I think is intriguing.
I didn't get that, but yeah, I don't disagree, but I didn't get that watching the film.
Yeah, it's what, only in certain scenes. I mean, obviously there are scenes set in exterior locations, like when Angier goes to meet Tesla, but it's a really interesting film. I mean, the supporting performances, you've got Scarlett Johansson, Rebecca Hall, Andy Serkis, as you said, Michael Caine,
David Bowie.
Yeah, I mean, we should say that Hugh Jackman, although Christian Bale doubles up, Hugh Jackman also doubles up brilliantly, playing the reprobate called Root, who is brought in as Angier's double, and it just reinforces what a brilliant actor Hugh Jackman is, like, and what a great job the makeup team did, because you kind of look at it the first time and think, is that Hugh Jackman playing the guy that's meant to look like Hugh Jackman's character? And you think, oh, it is. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very clever. All that layering and duplication and doubling. I think it's fantastic. Love the film's bits.
Yeah. I like I said, I can't disagree with you. I think it's an absolute masterpiece, and I thoroughly recommend anybody to watch it. If you haven't already, we've kind of ruined it for you, so I'm sorry about that. We did warn you.
I mean, I suppose the only thing we could say is that we can't possibly ruin Tenet yet. One, we haven't seen it, and two, we can't explain what the heck's going on from the trailer, which is a good thing.
No, yeah, I mean, it's great to still have this level of secrecy surrounding a film coming out, because, you know, when you go into a Marvel movie, and you know as much as I, that I'm an absolute mark for the Marvel movies. I'm there for every single one, and I'll read everything that's going online. And the fact that you already sort of know about who's got a multi-film deal and who's got X amount of films left on their contracts. And I'm not going to say it takes away from the tension, because it kind of doesn't in the moment, but in retrospect, you go, oh yeah, of course. Like, so to not know anything about a film before going into it, I think is Nolan's true genius at this point in time. And he's almost like, I'm reluctant to say this, because I did say it in my dissertation when I wrote it, that Chris Nolan is the heir apparent to Kubrick's crown within Hollywood, in that he's got the freedom to move about the studio system and make huge blockbusters or huge blockbuster films by their budget, but not necessarily in terms of the type of film that they are. And I do still think that holds true. What do you think?
I couldn't agree more about that. I think that Christopher Nolan is in an astonishing and very enviable position whereby he's built up so much financial collateral because none of his movies have lost money. And I think he's built up astonishing levels of loyalty with Warner Brothers in particular. Warner Brothers are his staple distributor. Mm-hmm. And clearly the success of all of his films, particularly the Dark Knight trilogy, has earned him the right to make a film like Dunkirk in the way that he wants. You think how much of a hard sell Dunkirk is, an experimental World War II movie with no American characters in it whatsoever. How on earth are you going to sell that just to an American audience, let alone an international audience? But it worked. It took 500 million worldwide. It was a huge hit.
Yeah, and especially the fact it was a story that not many people in America knew. It wasn't a known thing over there. So, whereas over here, it's the great British spirit, and look what we did at Dunkirk. Whereas to them, it was completely unknown. It was just something that the British did.
Yeah, and Christopher Nolan was only able to make that film, and he was only able to make that a success because of the success of his previous movies. Put him in a very, very unique position relative to a lot of other filmmakers. I also think that when you mentioned secrecy earlier, I think what Christopher Nolan has done brilliantly is he's weaponized secrecy. He's turned secrecy into a kind of lucrative marketing art form. By holding back, you make the audiences want more, which is a brilliant approach.
Mm-hmm. And it works, because you go to a Christopher Nolan movie just to find out what's happening. And in the case of Inception, loads of people walked out after having seen the film, still going, what's happening? I don't quite know. So, it makes people then go back for the multiple viewings, which is what I think his financial success has been staked on.
So are we saying that Christopher Nolan is the real showman behind the theme of this particular episode?
I think we are. I think, or Hugh Jackman, because he was in both.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that's true.
So let either or. Quite happy to for people to pick either or. So that will just about do us for Frame to Frame this week. As discussed, we do tend to pick films and sort of slam them together on the basis of strange themes that you might not necessarily ever put together. And on that subject, our next theme will be 80 sports films that are really about fatherhood. So that'll be interesting. We'll be announcing the films on our Twitter feed on Friday. You can follow us on Twitter, which is at Frame to Frame 2. So that's Frame, T-O, Frame, and then the number 2. Or you can follow us on Instagram, which is Frame underscore 2 underscore Frame 250. And we will reveal the films on Friday like if you're listening to this on Tuesday, that's when the films will tend to be released. Hopefully you'll be able to watch them along with us on the weekend. And then when we're talking about them, you will not spoil anything. Because in the case of The Prestige, we've kind of told you exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, you know everything about it now, yeah.
So I'm really, really looking forward to this, the next theme, because one of the films I haven't seen in a long time, which I know is a particular favourite of yours, and another one is... It is what the name says it is, so I'm really looking forward to it.
And one of those I haven't seen at all, so that's going to be an eye-opening experience for me.
Yes, so I'm particularly looking forward to that one. Because if we can get a good 20-odd minutes out of that film, I'll be impressed.
Well, let's set a target. Let's do it.
We will set that and see what we can do. But if you want to get in touch with us, feel free to hit us up on either of the socials. Until next time, that has been Frame to Frame for this week. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.